welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage.
Welcome.
Unclassifiable number, barely classifiable title. I believe this is Naturalism and Its Discontents 4, bringing the war back home edition. But
we have returned, of course. This is a merger project of Barnvlog and the Antifada. We've been at it for some time now.
Almost 2 years.
Almost 2 years. That's great, actually. I feel like we've done a lot of good work. I know that there's a lot of people out there who appreciate it. So thank you out there for listening to us go off on various different matters. But the nationalism question, right? We continue on this. When you and I were texting back and forth the other day, I had to ask whether the sort of, I wouldn't say gnomic, but like the vague sort of like conception of what this episode is going to be, which is the nation and class construction. Is that right? I was trying to kind of figure out in my head how this tied into our larger debate. But I feel like we're going to have maybe a looser episode this time. We'll have maybe the opportunity that you're going to bounce some ideas off of me and I'll bounce some off of you. And we'll see where the conversation takes us.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the questions that's come up for me, I recently went through Alex Tocilli's American Affairs article on the three postmortems of the millennial left, the Vincent Bevins, if we burn Jaeger and Borielli's The Populist Moment, and Chris Cotrone's Death of the Millennial Left. Alex's own, you know, notes towards an understanding in that piece. And I went back. I've been doing a, like, so far 15-part series on the history of the reception of the Critique of the Goethe Program and how it became an important text.
Mm.
And I noticed a shift that had not really struck me before. And then I noticed it again when reading Alvin Guldner's The Two Marxisms, which is a sympathetic-ish, like, trying to do Marxism to Marxism reading from the late 70s by this renegade sociologist, Alvin Guldner, who died before this was published. But it's interesting to read. It is very much a document of the end of the New Left. And kind of an intimate critique from an aging sociologist, well, a dying actually sociologist at the time. And one of the things I noticed that's going to be relevant to how we talk about this today is the tension between national and international class development that begins in Lenin. Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about this before. But in Marx and even in Engels, while there is an early Marx and early to mid Engels, there's like a notion of historic peoples. It's maybe even a little bit low-key racist. There's a lot of stuff going on there. And late Marx and Engels, there is an attempt to separate nationalization from socialization, and they go back and forth on it. This difference, while recognized by Lenin and State and Revolution, completely kind of falls away from Marxist analysis by the Third International. Like, it's just kind of gone. And the reason why I bring that up is one of the things that came up in the debates that I did not know about. I always thought this was an anarchist versus Marxist debate. But that one of the debates that Martov had with Lenin when Martov decided to join the Bolsheviks later is that Martov was worried about the over-centralization of the party in this nation-state building apparatus with the centralization thing, not just from the standpoint of like too much control in one basket, you know, not just from the whole like red despotism argument, but also from the fact that Martov was afraid that if you if you have one singular center running all of Russian society, all you have to do to take it over is take over one governmental apparatus.
Right.
And Martov was arguing with Lenin that centralizing the apparatus like this, even though that was Marx and Engels' initial, that's their argument against both, like, all kinds of different socialists and particularly anarchists, that this was a problem. Now, what does that have to do with nationalism? Okay, that's a long text-heavy introduction, right? But it brings up three questions. We talk about national proletariats and national developments, etc. One of the interesting things to the Russian question that the Guldner brought up when I was thinking about this debate between Martov and Lenin. And for those of you who don't know, I should not assume that everyone knows all the arcana of Soviet history. Martov was a Menshevik who basically, in opposing Lenin, keeping someone in the party that he thought was immoral, who was immoral, actually, to be completely frank, led to the Bolshevik-Menshevik split. But when the Mensheviks started siding with the whites, Martov went over to the Bolsheviks, so he was not a traitor. He was ultimately sided with the revolution, but he disagreed with Lenin the entire time. Lenin respected him. Stalin did not. Stalin kind of squandered his funeral, for example. But Martov was this he's kind of the middle figure between Plekhanov and Lenin in the development of Russian Marxism and the revolutionary currents of Russia, because the other revolutionary currents were either populist or liberal. That was what they were.
Or cadets, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the Narodniks are cadets, are sometimes SRs, sometimes anarchists. But the anarchist had a very Narodniki flavor in Russia.
Right.
So why is all that relevant? Okay, so you realize when I'm reading the drafts of the letter to Vera Sasulik, which is this whole debate. I'm not going to get into why I was reading it. It had to do with whether or not Engels is a bad guy.
No, we've been that one a few times lately.
To answer people who are interested in that question, the answer is not really. But
that's what Daniel Tutt and I came to in our episode a couple months ago.
Lenin has a few minor variations from Marx, but they're minor. And also, I'd rather hang out with Engels, Engels. And I'd rather hang out with Engels at a party than Marx, frankly.
Drink the finest wine, have a fox hunt or something. Well, they both aspired to live a bourgeois life. It's just one had the means and the other didn't.
Right. And also, social morality and whatnot, Engels was less conservative than Marx.
Very true.
The point I'm getting to here, though, is that there's an ambiguity even in the normal reading of the Vera Sasulik letters, where you have this discussion of the Russian Mir being able to pick up on the developments of the capitalist world through a socialist revolution and the, quote, what we would now call the core, but what they would then call the advanced nations. The interesting thing that I realized is unsettled in that letter is, what's the organ that's doing that? Is it the dictatorship of the proletariat in the West giving technological developments from capitalism to the Russian Mir directly, or are they giving it to some kind of central party apparatus or whatever?
Or some body of armed men.
Right, some body of armed men. And it is not clear at all in the letter what mechanism Marx thinks that should go into. It is clear, however, that while, and I know for those of you who are surprised at this, while Lenin actually talks about you can't have a state in a class society, period, end of discussion, even Lenin says that. that Lenin's assumption that the centralized development of the nation and proletarian relationships being effectively a national affair is an ambiguous tension with this other idea of independent forces within different national groups that could cooperate separately from any national development plan. So that's
the socialization versus nationalization debate that you're pointing to. Mm-hmm. So if I can try to make this clear for myself. So you have this debate that goes back to the presumably the 1840s, 1850s, and continues up until the beginning of the Soviet experiment with trying to understand the mechanism by which or the container, you know, that will be filled up with the proletarian enterprise, whether that's the state or whether that's society in a sense, mm-hmm. right? Socialization, of course, for Marxists means more than just, you know, how one becomes part of a society. It's a process of interconnection and it's a process of constructing and building society that happens in the course of capitalist development that causes like a true interdependence between people in a way that certainly in feudalism and past modes of production, it didn't. So is the question then that, are you arguing that these two things ended up being like elided or like the difference between them became elided? Or are you
I'm arguing that they became elided and that Marx is deliberate. And I think it's deliberate ambiguity. I actually do. I don't think Marx knows. The reason why I think that is all these letters that you read from Marx, where he's going back and forth about the end of the International Workingmen's Association and then his development of an international section of the SPD. The SPD is a national party in the beginning of the sense that we now mean it in the 20th century.
Mm, a mass political party.
Right. Whereas party for Marx and Engels for most of the 19th century does not mean a political party the way we mean it.
Doesn't mean Democrats or Republicans.
No, it does not mean. It
means like an amalgamation of social forces under like a political arm.
It's what we call an orgar group of anything. Any orgar group that had any political aim at all, whether or not it was electoral or not, would be a party.
Yeah. That distinction is one that I think bedevils people to this day, obviously, because, you know, the party, understanding the party or building the party, people automatically jump to the modern definition of it, right? But you're saying that with the rise of the SPD, which is to say like a practical nation-based, I almost said national socialist, but nation-based socialist political party actually vying for power within parliament, that the distinction between an older conception of the party and then our more modernist conception starts to arise, such that maybe we have lost sight of what might be unique about the party.
Right. I think that is where this is at. And now let's like fast forward ahead and what this has to do with nationalism, class formation in the United States or anywhere. The proletariat in the US is bound in a way that is going to be a problem. This has been true for all proletariats since the beginning of Marxism. Philip Neal of friend of both our shows now. Thank you, Sean.
Oh, yeah. I'm hyped that you guys got them on. That's great.
And I talked about this, and this is why he got, you know, he's been kind of developing a neo-communization theory. I mean, it's probably the communization theory round four.
Yeah.
But it is really rigorously based in both geographic trends and the larger situation for national proletariats, and I'll get to that in a minute. The issue that you have between socialization and nationalization leads to the entire fucking reason in Notes Volume 4, History Separation, actually becomes important. Mm. National developmentalism becomes the primary way that Marxism spreads. But what that actually does not empower the proletariat anywhere. What it actually does is proletarian and petit bourgeois, most of the peasantry within a underdeveloped nation. Right. That's its history. That's undeniable. It's literally undeniable that's its history.
Yeah.
The problem that you have today, and it's an obvious problem to people going all the way back to Chernyshevsky, the Russian populist leader in the 1850s. He saw that leapfrogging was fucking possible. But what leapfrogging meant was the amount of people needed for technological developments to happen goes down each round of development.
Right.
All right. Now, this leads us to two problems. We have a national developmental model that has been assumed as the model since probably the 1930s. Mm-hmm. It is rooted in the centralization nationalization model that we have as Lenin's solution to a problem of Russian development. The Russian model is dependent on there being masses of peasantry, including those masses of peasantry into the proletariat and centralizing them either through collective labor or through the introduction of the world market, are in the case of the Soviet Union, both depending on the time period.
Right.
And in the case of China, first one and then the other.
Yeah.
This, however, has diminishing returns for the amount of the proletariat you can create. Mm-hmm. So for example, the Second International focused solely on the industrial proletariat. Kautsky's is clear about that. It is the developmental model. Today, there are a lot of socialists who really, really, really want to go back to that orientation.
Sure.
And focus on the industrial proletariat. Here's the problem. Even in the United States, at the height of Fordism, that's 30% of the population. The most industrialized nation that has ever existed was Germany at the beginning of the 20th century. Why was it the most industrialized? Because it didn't have any colonies that outsourced anything to. Right. That was actually part of the argument for it. It wasn't imperially integrated. It had to develop efficiently. So it being like the periphery of the advanced nations late to the imperialism game meant that it would be the prime nation moving from America and England, where Marx and Engels first thought it might actually pop off initially. Okay. Let's remember that. To Germany as the core nation to transition. The problem which led to the revisionism controversy is you only ever hit 42% of the population in Germany. No country has ever gotten higher than that as a percentage of population. Even today, in almost completely modernized China, there's still like 5% who are effectively peasants. The industrial density of China, even at the height of its production in the last 10 years, is not the height of Germany's. It's not.
It's not an absolute majority, and it's not even the 42% that Germany reached.
Right. Furthermore, Phil Neal's work, which is devastating, he began applying to the United States and hinterlands, but he's now applying to the entirety of the planet, indicates that the centralization thesis, one of the reasons why everyone's in fucking services and no one ever thinks about it, or why there's a PMC and a huge massive service sector or whatever, is that all this is needed to maintain the logistics trains and do the social reproduction for logistics for increasingly centralized production that employs very few people. Right. This actually bucks the trend that Engels predicted. Engels thought that the proletariat would be increasingly centralized because factories would get more and more centralized. There'd be more and more people needed to do it. Even though it get more efficient, we produce more and more, but they'd be in centralized production factories and they'd be massive.
Something that looks like Fordism, but continuing forever.
Right. The problem that you have is that both geographically and in terms of need of people needed to be employed, the necessary industrial proletariat drops as technology reduces socially necessary labor time. This is actually completely consistent with classic Marxism, but for some reason, Marx and Engels didn't think it was that important.
Already you have this huge disconnect, right, between like classical Marxist theory as it's being developed, the critique of political economy as it's being developed in the 19th century, and then not even the subsequent political theory that arises out of that, but the on-the-ground political theory in Marx and Engels' lifetime, right, is not keeping up with the radical consequences of capital and the theory of the decline of the rate of profit, and certainly the whole conception of surplus populations and surplus labor, reserve army of labor. That I guess, already was antiquated by the early 20th century, right?
But, right.
Yeah.
So, there's a bunch of things that we need to deal with that happen and that make Grossman less predictive now, even though I think the trends that Grossman describes are true. For those of you who don't know who Grossman is, Heinrich Grossman was a member of the Frankfurt School who got kicked out for being a positivist, really for probably being Stalin sympathetic after 1936. Hmm. Grossman came up with a theory of a final crisis. But he also, and I think this is an underdeveloped part of his work, also came up with a theory about what offsets final crisis, why it's a tendency and not an absolute decline ratio. Contravailing conditions or
people interested in this, for the show notes, I can put the episode we did with Ted Reese last year. Mm-hmm. So who's trying to revive Grossman's work.
Right. The issue that, Ted Reese and Rick Kuhn basically are the two people who really tried to, and Jarayus Banerjee in the 70s. Because Grossman, even though he wrote primarily in the United States, ironically, his work was not translated into English until the 70s by an Indian Trotskyist.
and the way that his work influences the Anglophone world is in a kind of offhanded way through Paul Maddox Sr. and then through Paul Maddox Jr. as well, who are Grossmanite.
Yeah.
Economy.
I mean, ironically, the Dutch Council Current and Exile picks it up, which makes it, which makes it really interesting. My point about bringing him up is he's dealing with things not in a nationalist framework. Grossman sees capitalism as a total economic totality.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem that you have, though, is the and the other thing I'm going to say is Grossman's theory is more worked out than everyone else, but Trotskyist, Maoist, traditional Marxist Leninist all believe the same thing that Grossman, that we were on an intimate final crisis between 1920 and 1950. Yeah. And in fact, that was what justified third periodism, where the communists wouldn't work with anybody. It's what justified the Popular Front too, because they figured that once the war was over, the final crisis would kick in the 1950s. When that doesn't happen, you have a new development of monopoly capital theory. It's a different monopoly capital theory from the original monopoly capital theory put in by Lenin and Bukharin in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason this is important for nationalism, though, is monopoly capital theory in the 1920s is also an economic development theory between imperial groupings and nations operating within them. Because okay. Bukharin and Lenin thought that capitalism had increasing contradictions. I think they were right about this. And that the state was increasingly involved in capital production and making decisions between different groups of capitalists.
Mm-hmm.
And that was both internal two states and between them, which was going to lead to wars. That's where Bukharin's theory of imperialism comes from, and that's where the modified theory that Lenin presents in his pamphlet comes from. Now, this means that Marxists for the 20th century were shifted totally on focusing on national policies. Let's go back to the problem of the industrial proletariat, and let's see why this actually starts changing.
Hmm.
Starts changing too. So in the early days, you have an admission that the Marxists are revising. Lenin admits that Lenin has a couple of innovations on Second International markets. He doesn't have that many, but he has a few. Revolutionary defeatism, the focus on both objective and subjective conditions as separate categories. That's also Lenin. And another thing that his theory of imperialism is different, which I think is right when he's writing it. I think it's wrong for the rest of the 20th century, which is
For the decline of the British Empire.
Right. It's right for the decline of the British Empire. It's right for what's going to happen in World War I.
Mm-hmm.
But let's look at what this ends up doing. So early on, even the Bolsheviks admit, we need a revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat and peasants. The proletarians are still leading the way but they're not leading the way alone. We have to include the peasantry as part of their dictatorship. So here we go. So we move from the dictatorship of the proletariat to the dictatorship of the proletariat and peasant. That's not, people think that's Maoism. That's in Lenin.
Right.
For
necessary reasons, given what they were facing.
The shift in Maoism is the concept of mass line, and also including a non-comprador petite bourgeois in that coalition. And the other, for those of you who don't know what that means, it means non-cooperating petty bourgeois elements who are left-wing centered and are fighting imperialism. This is a shift. The other thing is there's no longer a focus on the proletariat leading the way.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So you have that happening in the developing world. In the core world, you get stalled out. Social Democrats start really giving up on Marxism. The first thing that happens in 1918, after the end of World War II, and I actually didn't know this history. This is new to me. Edward Bernstein was part of the opposition to the SPD, who didn't join the communists, the United SPD. Mm-hmm. Most of the United SPD liquidated in two parties, the Communist Party and the KAPD, the like more left-com Communist Party.
Yeah, right.
And Bernstein doesn't. He goes back to the SPD because the war's over. And what he starts doing, and I learned this researching Karl Korsch's response, because I was trying to figure out why Karl Korsch thought the Critique of the Goethe premise was so important. Mm. What he starts doing is reviving Ferdinand LaSalle and small and national socialism, and trying to reintegrate the German historical school socialists back in with the SPD. So this is taking the socialist right back into the SPD. They're going to develop a developmental program under Hilferding. That's going to be the SPD of the 1920s. This is in some ways a huge betrayal, because while like what happened to the Spartzbund and stuff caused you know, revolt in Bernstein, and he hated the Ebert government. As soon as all that settled, he immediately goes back in the SPD and immediately tries to revive LaSalle.
Mm.
So you have this creation of a kind of national development bloc in the West that's going to develop into both social democracy and Eurocommunism.
Mm-hmm.
Important
to say this isn't just theoretical, because the SPD is part of the tripartite coalition that runs almost the entirety of the Weimar period.
Absolutely.
And chaotically, as we know.
Right. Right. And it's going to lead, you know, it's going to lead to a lot of the SPD dying in the concentration camps.
Right.
The question that you have here, it's also the beginning of there being two different internationals. So you have the Third International, and then a kind of Second International 1.5, which later becomes a later on like S Socialist International, separate from the,
which is like the Labor Party and PASOK, yeah, is in it, and
yeah, the DSA was in it till like, yes, 2016. Like, yeah, yeah. And you start seeing concessions to national, like more and more national methodological. Birth in LaSalleism, later in the wholesale adaptation of British Keynesianism into socialism.
Right.
This leads to a new problem. So we've had the problem of the industrial proletariat isn't as big as Marx and Engels predicted. The developmental patterns to this day actually mean that each round of industrialization requires fewer workers, and you have the creation of more and more service workers and petite bourgeois professionals to service and maintain, right, these large corporate systems.
And importantly, for the socialist project, these service tertiary activities tend to be, you know, in addition to production being decentralized across regions and across nations and continents, this service work never attains like the mass character that industrial production had in the past, because the workshops and the shop floors and the offices are much tiny, more spatially distributed, because, yeah, you're dealing with paper and you're dealing with, moving services around, not industrial.
Yeah. essentially, it actually replicates the Martov argument for why you shouldn't centralize everything. So this leads to a couple of different responses. There's been a lot of debates today about why the millennial left screwed up, but this really comes to a head in the new left. We think the new left thought all this up because of bad ideas, our identitarianism or liberalism or whatever. Motherfuckers, we're all liberal. We live in a liberal society.
Right.
like you might think you're beyond it, but you live in that society. When you say, oh, the left of capital, you're also the fucking left of capital. Sorry, left communist. Like, there is no society.
There's only capital in a very Postonian way, right?
Right. There's only capital now. Capital, even if you think the PRC is trying to get away from capitalism, they are disciplined by the international market just like everybody else. Yep. The fact that they can assassinate a few key bourgeois figures just means that their leadership is a little bit more bold than ours, but that's it.
Right.
So we have a bunch of problems developing. Okay, so what does it have to do with methodological nationalism, class formation? Okay, one, services, while they are all, and these logistic trains, while they are also, how do you put it? And this is an insight that I do get from EndNotes Volume 4. While they are also diffuse, ironically, they're nationally bound. Mm-hmm. Logistics require government infrastructure, services. Services aren't just nationally bound. They're fucking like area bound in a very real way.
They're regionally
yeah. bound, like municipally bound and otherwise.
And it surprises us when they actually take on a national character, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you'll all of a sudden see a new brand in town and you'll be like, what the hell is that? And you realize it's been operating in the South for 70, like, 80 years, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
The Mr. Pibb theorem.
yeah. Cheer Ryan being available in Utah, you know, that sort of thing.
Yingling beer being available in New York.
Yeah. Yingling beer being available in Georgia, too. Right. I remember being excited for that before everybody had microbrews.
When we were young, my grandfather, they lived down there. They brought up Yingling as like a special occasion up north every once in a while. By up north, I mean 90 miles away, but it seems so.
Actually, beer is a perfect example of this.
It is.
Beer moves from being a mass-produced commodity to a locally produced service because a mass-produced commodity is not particularly profitable.
Mm.
Think about like why. I mean, yes, they're still making a physical commodity in beer, just like a pizza shop is still making a physical commodity in a pizza. It is a commodity, but like it's a highly consumable commodity with a low profit margin. But you can survive off of it in a regional distribution chain. You can't. Those profits do not scale up. So what you see is the end of shit corporate beer, which is a mass-produced commodity, back to like regional artisanal beers. But that is treating a commodity like a service.
Right.
So this leads us This leads us to a couple different problems. Okay, so how does the left respond to this? One, you see the beginning of political Marxism, small m. I'm going to say that. Our cosmonaut friends might call it political first Marxism.
Mm.
All right. It's the belief that while the workers' movement was real, it is actually the workers for themselves as represented by the party, not by the workers' own actions.
Yeah.
That represents the actual living workers' movement because the social movement, the sociological construct of the workers' movement is not thick enough. This tension is in Marx, the in itself tension, it's there, but Marx never uses it to say that, like, well, the party represents the real interests of the proletariat, despite what the proletariat itself says. Mm-hmm. It actually says that the proletariat itself has to become aware of itself and then it can act for itself through its most advanced members.
Right.
Okay. So that leads to one thing. Still a national question, though, because these parties are national parties. That's what they focus on, and they focus almost solely on the nation. They can't, however, scale up to the nation, so most of them become sects. That's what they do. Like, they become programmatic sects. They try to impose a program before they have mass membership. And in doing so, they become a statement of beliefs, and they probably cap out historically between 5,000 and 10,000 people. Most of them don't get that big. That's one response. The second response is the focus on the student movement. Mm-hmm. The initial reason for that, people think, was cynical. It does become cynical. Students have a lot of leisure time. You can use them.
So they can sell a lot of newspapers on campus.
Right. But originally, the idea was the nature of World War II in the developed countries have put the children of the proletariat into the universities.
Right.
Now,
into it's the, still... Into yeah. the education factory.
Right. It's still considered... It's still a relatively small group of students at this time. It's like 20% of the population, but that's like a fivefold increase for what it had been prior to World War II.
And there was a real sociological basis for it as well, because, you know, many of these children literally were, you know, the sons and sometimes daughters of factory workers and construction workers and, mm-hmm. you know, the traditional proletariat, being able to go to state universities for the first time almost for free. Right?
This leads to two different approaches. One approach, which leads to what we might call the left managerial theory, which is to take in the idea, well, there's these all these new managers, but they have a proletarian consciousness because they come from the proletariat, a lot of them. A lot of them have also seen World War II, or their parents saw it. So they are coming in with that reality. They're going to be radicalizable. They have free time. And they're going to enter the workforce. So you can take over the center and the bottom. How are they going to do that? Well, there's become two strategies for doing this. One is the Barbarian Reich strategy, which is the idea that the PMC is going to enter the workforce with a certain set of skills, but over time it's going to separate itself into two strata. One strata, which is going to become just purely petite bourgeois. The other strata, which is going to become a skilled set of the of a proletarianizing class. That's the Barbarian Reich strategy. She develops that from the 70s into the end of the aughts. That's her deal. The other theory becomes a kind of enlightened vanguard theory of, well, these can become a liberal elite set that we run through and kind of Gramscianly, a misunderstanding of Gramsci, but nonetheless, Gramscianly take over the institutions. Actually, Alvin Gulner, who I mentioned earlier, actually holds to this theory because they are not really bourgeois. It's sort of the James Burnham was right, but it's going to be good though.
Okay.
Theory. Then there is a kind of salt merger thesis. So there's an attempt by Trotskyist, Maoist, and other groups in the late 60s and early 70s to enter the workforce and like, okay, we're going to come in, but we're going to join the factories and we're going to salt them. Mm-hmm. This goes spectacularly poorly. Uh-huh. This creates people like Jay Sakai.
Right. Yeah.
Because the racial...
Or it creates the Teamsters for the Democratic Union, which sheds their Trotskyism in practical terms through the course of the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Right, right. Basically, it sheds their Trotskyism and it sheds their mob connections and like... Right.
As the Teamsters do.
You know, so that what that leads to is the Atari Democrats going, hey, look, there's this developed elite of oligarchy of union leadership. And this is one thing I hear from liberals is totally fucking ahistorical. All right. Another thing that the national that gets us focused on the national thing in a fucked up way. And I know what people are like, oh, there's so much history you're throwing at us at once here, but you can start to add it together. Mm. So while this is happening, the other thing that happens is deindustrialization starts to kick in. I don't know what percentage of the American population is in unions in the 1970s. I've seen various estimates. We actually don't have a good guess.
Maybe
30-40%. It's 30% in 1981. All right. The reason why I think it may have been higher is like you would assume in Fordism it was higher than that. Like
you would, but you had almost no public sector at that point in time. And
right.
There were professional like white collar unions, but much smaller than the blue collar unions at that point.
Right. So what happens? Okay, so the Atari Democrat people say, look, these unions are actually part of the management core. They've almost joined up with what we now call HR. They're resented by union membership. They're not accountable to them at all. They're paid in stock options. They're taught like the Atari Democrats are talking about this as early as like 81. We're going to see a massive deunionization. This is going to be organic. Reagan picks up on that.
Be a liberal.
Yeah. but that trend had already started. Carter had already started it. I mean, like, but the other thing that we forget, I was reading a book from 1971 by Richard Hyman about the British left. But one of the things that I was reading is like Labour Party leaders in Britain and Labour leadership were very unpopular by the end of Fordism. Mm. That was part of why the students were also seen as developing. One of the things that comes up in the Hyman book is that in the classical Marxist period, classical Marxists are very, very sanguine about industrial union leadership. Lenin is less sanguine about it, but he sees it as an unintended consequence, of developments within the union that tie them more and more to capitalist development. Trotsky thinks that they've been totally co-opted by the state. Mm. And while he doesn't actually go as far as like Norfite Trots of the World Socialist website do later on, he basically says, look, we are going to have to be at an all-out war with union leadership. This
he's talking specifically about the CIO.
Right. He's talking specifically about the CIO. You know, he's not talking about the AFL, the more reactionary union.
Right.
So this attitude, interestingly, while it starts in Trotskyism, by the time you get to the 1970s, only the old guard of the CPUSA rejects it. The new Marxist-Leninists and the new communist movement also have a hostile stance towards unions, mm-hmm. which is why they go in the SOT. They're going into these unions on a war footing. All right. So not only do you have the racial, ethnic, and other tensions that are emerging in the 70s in the United States as a problem for this, not only do you have the fact that this is nationally bound, but we are really beginning to see international capital in a very real way. The world market has always been a part of the problem. It's been a tension in Marxism, you know, and something that Marxists have noted to Marx. Like Marx saw this national, international tension in bourgeois culture from moment one. But it's really at the height of the contradictions in the 1970s. Two things have changed. One, nuclear war and the Cold War means the old offsets for how you get out of productivity crisis, which is not intentional. People, I'm not saying that anyone sets out to start a war, but interstate competition with loss of excess shit leads to that excess surplus being put in the weaponry. It's going to usually lead to a war.
Look at Russia right now, right? We see what happens after that process. You see their economy seemingly booming right now at this point.
Well, I mean, yeah, it'll boom and then it'll dramatically slow down if the history is an indication.
Seemingly, I say.
Yeah. But it does get rid of all this excess capital. It valorizes society. It mandates production. You're literally destroying what you make so you can just continue to make more of it.
Right. Yeah. Perfect commodity. Heroin's the perfect commodity, but
yeah.
Weapons number two.
So you see this explode, right? But these tendencies that we saw in the beginning of the 20th century there's now geopolitical reasons why they can't happen. So we've already mapped these national responses to the global proletariat. We've already said, one, the Soviet Union's relying on developmentalism of backwards or periphery or developing, pick your word of choice.
Yeah.
Third world, whatever the fuck you want to call them.
I think important to point out too in this history, and something that struck me and I think is correct, is that both the Soviet Union and the post-split Bernsteinite Weimar social democrats shedding Marxism are both on the same national developmental project, right? Just it's a relative use of markets.
So the difference is whether or not you think the Communist Party the Socialist Party should control the markets, or whether they're part of a coalition with the progressive forces of capitalism to develop it, and then we'll separate and have a revolution later. It's not a difference in.
And did the SPD believe that? Were there people through the 1920s and 1930s who still believed that?
What, that you needed a two-stage revolution?
Yeah.
Actually, weirdly, no. The critique, even as early as the 1910s, by Daniel De Leon in the U.S. from the left, and I guess from the right, in quotation marks, by Plekhanov's, is you didn't need to muck up these revolutions by having them at the same time. Mm. That If you had them at the same time, it was going to confuse whose values you were going to do. Plekhanov thought it would lead to rivers of blood and, quote, and development like the Incan empires, is what he says. So basically, like, mass despotic developmental regime. De Leon's critique is similar but different. De Leon thinks that it's going to, like, it's going to confuse people to what are liberal and what are socialist values, and they won't be able to separate the two. But more or less, by the time that you get into the Bernstein era, Bernstein, LaSalle, and Fabian have all kind of collapsed into one sort, like Fabian socialism a la Britain, have kind of collapsed into one sort of morass of Keynesian developmentalism that gets the Austrian economist, reactionary but kind of friend to Marxist author Schumpeter's theory. So they just think, oh, we're just going to develop capitalism so much, and the instability of capitalism is going to lead to a political revolution, and the political revolution will lead to socialism without violence, or with only with defensive violence, depending on the time period. But eventually it becomes without violence at all.
There's the Keynesian vision, right, of like, what is it, the economic conditions of our grandchildren, the conception that the productivity of capital will rise to the point where you'll de facto in society have a sort of market socialism where people only have to work, like, you know, 4 hours a week or something like that.
Right. And that's, you know, and you know what, you know why Keynesians believe that? And you know why a lot of monetary theorists believe that? They don't have a theory of value. All right. Because from the value theory, the more you reduce socially necessary and labor time, the more you can exploit people.
Right.
Right, not the more free time they have. There's no reason why capitalists would give you that free time back.
Right.
But anyway, so you have this kind of, basically social democracy becomes a morass of different theories, really dominated by the British, either in the Fabian or the Keynesian, or later on in the British resurgence of German historical school Chartalism. Not going to go into that history, but that's like state theory of money. That's what David Graeber's on about. That's what, like, half my show. That's what all the people think we just print our way out of any crisis think. They don't actually think that. I would actually say MMT's real theory is a little bit more complicated than that, but it is a totally nationalist. They almost view economies as nationally autarkic.
I'm curious where the Milibands fit into all this and the Tony Benns of the world.
Well, by the time you get to Miliband and whatnot, I think they are.
Are those considered Euro communists at that point, or are they just the left wing of the Labour Party?
They're the left wing of the Labour Party. That some of them have Trotskyists. Euro communists are kind of the right wing of the Comintern aligned parties in Europe.
Okay.
So, yeah. The Eurocommunism, you know, develops this too because they think the automation is going to, like, make the labor. They actually start agreeing with the Keynesians. The automation is going to make all this unnecessary. We don't need the working class anymore. So the long and short of it is that by the 1970s, not just the new left, everybody has abandoned the working class as a revolutionary politic, except for the Italian autonomists. So, who are like, no, now we have to go it alone. We can't. Now, why is this a problem? All right. Why is this a problem? Well, you have the observation made by both anarchists and communizers and by Maoists, to be fair. They all agree on this, that you never have a proletarian revolution in a developed country. That all the revolutions are coalitions of the proletarian and peasantry. This leads to a crisis in the 1980s, all right, where basically people think that Marx is just wrong. That either they drop value theory, which you start starting to see happen in Western academics in the 1950s with the second wave of monopoly capitalism. And what does that do? That makes it okay to make the working class not the subject of Marxism anymore, because either you believe they've been real subsumed to to which is a theory really comes out of a little later in the 70s. It's not really a part of monopoly capital, but the monopoly capital market's actually similar. The administrative state are the dialectic of the Enlightenment or whatever, depending on what version of this you're in. They're no longer the development. Mm. All right. In the core. This idea of labor aristocracy amongst unions gets started to be applied by Maoists in the 1970s to entire nations.
Uh-huh.
So it's no longer, hey, you're a labor aristocratic union boss, and maybe in an imperialist country
who's like pulling the wool over the eyes of the proletarians under you, who potentially still have some, because right. they're exploited, still potentially have some revolutionary capacity. Instead, right. that the entirety of that society is labor aristocratic.
It's labor aristocratic. This leads to a couple different developments, including weird things like Maoists who no longer believe in labor theory of value because you can't justify actual, like if you look at third world developmental patterns, you actually can't justify it with a labor theory of value. And you can't justify it off of productivity rates either. It leads to... it leads to Maoism splitting up into about five different things.
Hmm.
Dengism being dominant in China. So that is the beginnings of what we might call, and it's not really Deng. It's really one of Deng's philosophers. Phil Neal goes into all this, who comes up with, which is from the right, which comes up with this idea of socialism with Chinese characteristics. But ironically, okay, this is something that I don't hear talked about a lot. After it is not the Dengist. I actually didn't know this until I recently reread a lot of histories on the 70s China, including Ralph Ruckus's History of the Chinese Left from 1949 to now. So people know where I'm getting this from. But in the 1970s, the faction that Mao left in charge was not the Gang of Four, nor was it the Dengist. It was this people that were the centrist, like the Marxist centrist faction, that in history, the word for them gets translated basically to the whateverist faction. which
was 1970s.
which is to say, it was seen as a centrist faction without any ideology.
Right, okay.
So one of the ironies of the Dengist right is they actually came to power partly off of right-wing nationalist responses, but also off of left wings being fed up with the whateverist faction and the liquidation of the Gang of Four. So Deng actually rides both to power.
So it's similar to Stalin's rise to power then.
Right.
Interesting. Deng is a Stalin type figure.
I mean, I think Deng is like the last true Stalinist in a lot of ways. The extent of the liberalizations, I think, is missed in the West. Like, it's not just that they open the market up. I've talked about this with Maoist actually, from China, who was like, no, they did stuff like they quit paying for the schooling of rural women and shit like that. Like it was an extreme. It was more liberal in the privatization sense than 19th century United States. It actually slowed the rise of the standard age, so the aggregate age, freezes during the Deng period for working class and rural people for 20 years.
Wow.
All right. So for people who like, oh, Deng made China wealthy, maybe by the 2000s, that's true. But in the 80s and 90s, it actually stalled the gains in lifespan. So...
Revolutionary process was happening was in the special economic zones, right? And those are special because they were not generalized. They were places where Western capital, not even Western, but more like Hong Kong capital and expatriate Chinese capital could come and start to invest. But then in a molecular fashion, of course, like these grow larger and larger. But what you're arguing too is that there was what we could call like a neoliberal project happening on the mass scale outside of the social, the special economic zones at the same time, which are like the counterpoint to that.
Right. I mean, Xi's modification to Dengism is basically adding early 20th century welfare to the Chinese state. That's what he's done.
Not too much though, because that's welfareism.
Right. Not giving people direct money. We can't do that. But yeah, like,
you can't forget the other aspect of this. And this is in Chuang Wan, I think, which is that, you know, all through the 1990s and the early 2000s, industrial employment was kind of a wash between the deindustrialization of the old state-run Manchurian industrial plant that had existed starting in the 1950s, actually going back to the Japanese, and then mass state industrialization using Soviet technicians and technology. That still exists. You know, it's decrepit, but it still exists in the 1980s and 1990s. But that, the loss of employment with the shutting down of those, is only actually matched by the unemployment in the private sector and in town and village enterprises in like the liberalizing sections of the rest of China.
Yep. So I'm
going to shift even than an industrialization. It's a shift in the form of industrialization, the ownership structure of industrialization, and of course, like the actual proletariat itself, because you're proletarianizing new parts of society, and the old iron rice bowl sectors of society are losing the privileges that have been won in the revolution.
Right. And China has amazing social cohesion, actually, but it's, I think that's not because of Confucianism or anything like that. I think it's because of the experience of the Cultural Revolution, where like you pushed all these intellectuals out into the countryside. And while even Chinese people in like the PRC, like, oh, that was bad, it actually led to a highly educated, socially integrated rural population. That had every now and then I'll read Christopher Lash talk about like the Cultural Revolution as anti-education. I'm like, bullshit. It was anti, like, you're reading that in the context of Western education. Like, it was anti-Confucian aristocracy, which was an educational aristocracy, that's pre-modern. And it was about skill sharing in both directions. So the intellectuals were going to learn like practical skills from the peasantry, and the peasants were going to learn reading and writing and basic engineering and shit.
The distinction between mental and manual labor, right?
Right. Michael Sandel, when went to China, one thing he notices amongst the Chinese youth, in addition to most of them being only children, and most of them being meritocratic in a Western way, which the other thing that he notices is that civic stuff is not there because they have no experience of that shared society the way their parents and grandparents do.
Interesting.
So we're going to see a big shift. Okay, so I'm going to recap this so we could go behind the paywall, but I want to recap it for everybody because there's a lot of stuff I've thrown at everyone. One, big trends. Industrial proletariat never big enough. This leads to a crash that's in the middle of the 20th century. This crisis is actually the crisis that led to the millennial left. We're going to talk about that at the end of the thing. Two, all the answers to this ended up being different kinds in different periods because nationalism is divided on uneven, but they all ended up being national answers. All right. Three, none of them actually work. All right. Okay. Except for the developmentalism, but what it works to do is to create capitalist countries and to get rid of the peasantry. That's right. What it does. Four, this leads to a crisis in fragmenting of Marxism that we have not really dealt with. A lot of people today do not realize they're picking and choosing from Marxists that have completely broken apart frameworks, and they don't even understand how they're broken apart. So, and maybe that could be intellectually useful as people figured out how they were broken apart, but like, you can't be a world systems theorist and an analytic Marxist or whatever. Like, you can't, like, these things are incompatible with each other. But all of them rely on basic conceptions of national development. Furthermore, the other thing that changes is you keep moving the goalposts of what the national development needed for communism is. All right. Engels said that they had what they needed for communism in 1880. They didn't in 1848, but they did by 1880. Like, so it is not, you know, if anything, the problem that you have is as capitalism develops, what you need to communize, it gets higher and higher too.
Right.
So this leads to all kinds of problems. And then in 1992, which is a good place to end this, I think, the Soviet Union fucking falls. And one of the things that I find weird whenever we talk about the Gen X and millennial left is so much of it doesn't mention that the Soviet union fell apart in 1992.
In our lifetimes, the people of our age literally saw that happen, and it colored, of course, everything that came after that as we developed politically and made choices and read people and tried to understand the world and have hope for the future. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So this leads us to the question is, are we, and this I think we're going to play with behind the paywall, are we back to the conditions of the First International, where you are dealing with so many different kinds of groups? Because I want to tell all those social democrats who are complaining about the PMC and think we can go back to the industrial proletariat. If I include management and logistics in the concept of the industrial proletariat, it is 15%. Of the population in the developed world and like 20% of the population in developing. And no place on earth are the masses proles in the industrial sense of that term. Now they are proles in the wage relation sense of that term in the developed world. All right. They're not necessarily in developing, but in no place are most of the proletariat, the industrial proletariat. And so if you think productivity, if you think industrial shop things, if you want that back, you live in the wrong world. And even if you reshore all those industries to the United States today, they will employ a 20th or a 30th of what they employed in the 1970s.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a drum I've been banging for a while. And I think that we have some great ammunition for going behind the paywall and exploring this stuff more. Folks, if you're not a subscriber to Varnblog, patreon.com/Varnblog. If you're not one to the Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada. We do some of our best work behind the paywall. If you'd like to see our faces, if you'd like to see what it is that I ingest during the course of these various episodes, then you're going to want to check out Varnblog. You can watch the video there. But anyways, folks, sign up and we will see you on the other side. Thanks for listening.
Right.